Chapter 13. The Mysterious Case of the Dirty Gas. Our bodies are so covered with bacteria that there are 10 million bacteria to be found on every square centimeter of our skin. Fortunately, most of them are friendly. And we thought maybe they stop there, our skin being presumed to be the boundary of our bodies. But then we found out that things are not as simple as that. In late September 2015, a flurry of news reports appeared in the media about an article that had been published in a scientific journal by Dr. James F. Meadow, an American microbiologist, then doing postdoc work at the University of Oregon, where his PhD was in ecology and environmental sciences. He has now become the lead data scientist at the law firm Dillon Harrison's biotechnology service, Phylogen, in San Francisco's Bay Area. In his article, Meadow reported the results of experiments he carried out with a group of people concerning the bacteria that he knew covered all human bodies. What he discovered was that the bacteria formed unique clouds surrounding the bodies. His scientific report on his findings was published in the online journal PeerJ on 22nd of September 2015 by him and six colleagues. The amazing findings revealed that people can be uniquely identified from their bacterial clouds, which are equivalent to fingerprints or iris scans. We're used to having cameras all over our city streets now, taking images of us, but they may be joined by sniffers, sniffing our clouds if we're not careful. Everybody is surrounded by a cloud consisting of millions of bacteria. The exact sizes of these clouds have not yet been measured, but the clouds appear to extend for several feet beyond the body in all directions. When we walk around, therefore, we are really clouds of bacteria with a hard core called a physical body. As for the body itself, the cells within it, and supposedly constituting it, are outnumbered by the microbiological entities, bacteria, fungi, and viruses, living on it and in it by 10 to 1. What this means is that only 10% of the cellular components of ourselves are really what we think of as us, and 90% is a cloud of microscopic parasites that follows us around. However, most of that 90% used to be us and was ejected. So, if you follow the logic through, what this means is that 10% of us is currently us, 90% of us was us in the past, and thus we are, in a sense, made up of 90% past and only 10% present. Never in the course of human history has proof been so forthcoming that people really do come with baggage. According to Meadow and his team, humans emit 10 million particles per hour, which means that we emit 240 million particles per day into the air around us. Upon learning this, it did not take me long to figure out that the sedentary lives most of us live today, compared to the lives of our ancestors, who spent so much time outdoors having their bacterial clouds being buffeted and continually blown away by the winds and breezes, obviously means that the concentrations of our personal bacterial residues are much greater than those of our ancestors. If our houses are well insulated and have no breezes or airflows, as older houses with open chimneys always had, then we are living daily in incredibly dense concentrations of bacteria, fungi, spores, and viruses. In Meadow's studies of microbial clouds, he specified that the particles in those clouds included also resuspended dust and emission from clothing. So, in order to eliminate clothing dust from his experiments as a variable, he had all his subjects wear the same clothes. The billions of microbes we emit may be harmless to ourselves, but not necessarily harmless to people visiting us. for they have their own clouds, which are not necessarily compatible with our clouds, and they may be vulnerable to the highly intensified microbial concentrations in our excessively insulated home environments. The interactions of different people's bacterial clouds have not even begun to be studied, and neither is there yet a science of bacterial habitats for bacterial clouds. Although microbiology is constantly producing studies of bacterial colonies on and within humans, such as our microbiomes in our intestines, and on our cell phones, our computer keyboards, our doorknobs, and our TV remote controls. Getting nervous? You ought to be. The COVID-19 pandemic should have brought home to people by now the importance of what, during the epidemic, came to be called social distancing. In fact, being 6 feet, 2 meters, apart from each other, in order to avoid contamination of one another, is a confirmation that forbidding our surrounding microbial clouds to touch can prevent us getting infectious viruses. The irony is that none of the medical authorities who recommended this social distancing appeared to be aware of the existence of our microbial clouds. They instinctively knew that we must be 6 feet apart and justified this by speaking of airborne droplets or just because it seemed sensible. It is time they learned the full facts, which provide a sounder justification for their instinctive policies. The good news is that they pursued a sound policy in this regard anyway. Masks, however, make little difference to our microbial clouds and are pretty useless except in intensive care wards, because the viruses are 1,000 times smaller than the smallest holes in the masks worn by the public during the pandemic. Intensive care masks work. The ones made available to the public don't. Rather than speaking of bacterial clouds, we should more properly speak of microbial clouds, which include all species of entities emitted by our bodies at every moment of the day and night, and include fungi and viruses. And there is a close connection between these microbial clouds and dust, for a great deal of household dust comes from tiny bits of shed human skin, all of which carry bacteria on them, and those bacteria are carried off the body and then leave the skin flakes and float up into our microbial clouds and join in the merriment of being microbes together. Microbial clouds and dusty plasma are analogous in many ways, as both are made of invisible and microscopic particles. And later in this chapter and the next, I will be examining the work done on what are called our bioplasma bodies, which are invisible and which surround us just as the microbial clouds do. The concept of bioplasma bodies suggests that we are jointly constructed of physical bodies and bioplasma bodies, which operate in sync. The further suggestion is that when we die, in quotes, because our physical body has worn out or been damaged beyond repair, our bioplasma body may detach from our physical body and abandon it to, quote, death, unquote. We might be said to continue to exist as bioplasmic beings made of non-atomic matter of plasma. On this way of looking at it, the soul is thus material, but in a different and more rarefied sense than was the physical body. This leads to the concept of bioplasma beings existing without physical bodies, and I suggest that this is what is often referred to as the other world. Traditionally, it has been called the spiritual world, upon the assumption that it must be wholly immaterial. It was assumed that body and spirit were entirely separate, one being material and one being entirely non-material. I touched on this earlier, and it is what I regard as the prime fallacy of our Western civilization. As previously explained, it is not a fallacy that was ever traditionally adopted by the Chinese. But we must return to our discussion of the microbial clouds. What I want to raise as a question now is this. are the microbes in the clouds themselves charged? As we will see as we proceed, there are many researchers who insist that we have invisible counterpart bodies made of plasma, bioplasma, that surround us and extend several feet from us. So how does this relate to the fact that it has suddenly been discovered that there are invisible microbial clouds surrounding us? Could and should we call our microbial clouds our extended bodies? And could our bioplasma bodies be continually interacting with our microbial extended bodies or clouds? Or could they even be the same, with the microbes taking the place of the charged dust grains that one finds throughout space, for example, in dusty plasmas? And since all of those hundreds of millions of microbes that surround each and every one of us are alive, can they possibly all be coordinated by a plasma body that charges and energizes and forms them? Even if the microbes themselves are not charged, there is sufficient dust accompanying the microbes within the clouds to make it reasonable to say that we are all perhaps surrounded by charged microbial clouds, if only on the basis of the accompanying charged dust that is within them. As for the effect of charge upon bacteria and viruses, I know of no experimental investigation of this that has ever been undertaken. In a paper that is in preparation at the time of writing, I call for such experiments to be done. Things to be investigated include this question: if a virus is positively charged, does it act in one way? And if negatively charged, in another? We do not even have the answers to questions as fundamental as that. We have been through an entire pandemic without knowing whether we could have intervened against the COVID-19 virus by the use of electric charge or magnetic fields. That is a shocking dereliction by the worldwide medical profession. My own opinion is that COVID-19 viruses traveled on the winds in charged viral clouds protected by sheaths, which explains why outbreaks were able to take place on cargo ships at sea, which had no contact with anyone for 6 weeks. Now, this is not reported in the media, but believe me, there are several instances of it which are documented. How did they get COVID if they were not in touch with anybody for 6 weeks? What makes such a viral cloud suddenly dump may be connected with encountering powerful thunderstorms. The Earth itself is negatively charged, as all lightning experts will tell you. Ordinary rain varies in its charge. High rain is positively charged, while low rain is negatively charged. Most people do not know any of this. Virologists should really be given crash courses in geophysics. I would suggest that most or all bacterial or virus colonies are unified entities in some way, but that when it comes to microbial clouds, that must be true to a higher degree. If we all have invisible microbial clouds and also have invisible bioplasma bodies, and both surround our dense physical bodies, and both are approximately the same size, then how could they not interact with one another? Is it possible that the microbes that stream off us at the rate of 10 million per hour become charged by the bioplasma body, become subsumed within it, take on its shape, and lend substance to it? I do not see why not. Indeed, it may well be the microbes and dust continually sucked into our bioplasma bodies that enable our bioplasma bodies to function in relation to our physical bodies. When scientists can figure out how to do so, the sizes, shapes, and configurations of our microbial clouds will surely merit close study. In addition, we will need to examine the electrical charges, whether positive or negative or both, of the microbes and the accompanying dust within our personal clouds, and most important of all, try to determine whether the clouds have cellular internal structures. For if they do, That means that there are insulated pockets within the clouds that can contain microbes and dusts of highly varying characteristics. For instance, there could be cloud cells full of positively charged microbes, cloud cells full of negatively charged microbes, cloud cells in which toxins and pathogens are isolated, and charged double-layer boundary layers resembling membranes separating the cloud cells from one another. In the event of ill health, such boundary layers might break down, and pathogens that would normally have been safely contained get released. If we could determine such things happening, we would have early warnings of disease. We should also urgently undertake investigations of the effects of aerosol sprays on our microbial clouds. They would, in my opinion, be certain to alter the ultra-weak charged currents in our clouds. But before we can even examine that, we need to know what kind of charge aerosol particles carry. Are they positive or negative? Charge can be defined as a quantity of electricity or protosity. Charged particles are called particles because they are small, but they are called charged because they have either a positive charge, like a proton or ion, or a negative charge, like an electron. Positively charged dust particles and grains tend to be larger and slower moving than electrons. A positively charged dust grain can easily have 10,000 or more electrons adhering to its surface, like sperm chasing a single egg and irresistibly attracted to it. And yet no one appears ever to have thought about the charges that exist on aerosol particles, or particle sprays of perfume or cologne, dust particles from talcum powder, tissue dust when we wipe our noses, and antiseptic sprays that fill most restaurant serving areas as the staff wipe the tables using a technique of reconnaissance by fire. That is, first spray your way in, and then close with the enemy and wipe. If the adjoining customers choke, ignore them. Ignoring all these sorts of things is a danger to public health. I recommend the creation of a new scientific discipline, which could be called electromicrobiology. Scientists working in that field should attempt to study the charging of microbes and accompanying dusts. For instance, if you take a microbe and give it a positive charge, what is the difference between that and taking the same microbe and giving it a negative charge? How do groups or colonies of microbes behave when they are A, positively charged, B, negatively charged, and C, both? How do microbes of the same charge relate to each other, or the opposite charge? And how do these interactions differ from uncharged interactions? Putting aside the bacterial clouds, what about the human body itself? It is a little known fact that 1/50th of our body weight is made up of bacteria that are inside or on the surface, skin, of the body. And these are all in addition to the ones in the clouds that are outside the body. The number of bacteria living inside us is so great that our bodies contain 10,000 times more bacterial cells than actual human cells. And as for the surfaces of our bodies, as we have already learned, there are so many bacteria on our skin that approximately 10 million bacteria live on every square centimeter of our skin. They mostly live in the outer layer of the skin, the stratum corneum, which is made up of dead skin cells. So the surfaces of our bodies largely consist of dead human cells filled with enormous colonies of live bacterial cells. The total bacterial biomass on the Earth, now think about this, I'll say that again, the total bacterial biomass on the Earth is 1,000 times greater than the total world human biomass. Earth is thus the planet of the bacteria, not the planet of animals and humans. Furthermore, the bacteria multiply their numbers so fast that if we completely cleansed a patch of our skin of bacteria, it would take less than 12 hours for them to grow back again to the same numbers. And now we also know that in addition to that, we are surrounded by clouds of further bacteria and microbes, as I have just described. So what does that make us? Our bodies are largely bacterial support, incubation, and transport vessels. Fortunately, the majority of our bacteria are beneficial to us, for otherwise we would have died out as a species long ago. It is possible that most microbiologists of today do not know enough about plasma to realize that it acts as an excellent conductor of charged currents when there are imbalances of charge in the plasma, or when the plasma has a cellular structure, such as we find in the Earth's atmosphere, or in dusty plasmas such as the Kordolevsky clouds. As we have seen, cellular structure implies the existence of boundary layers, known as double layers, surrounding the cells, and these layers themselves carry currents, often very powerful ones. If the microbial clouds around us are charged by plasma or become part of a plasma cloud, or even generate a plasma cloud through their own charges, then they can potentially carry electric currents, whether electricity, negatively charged currents, or protosity, positively charged currents. And of course, once you have electric currents, you get magnetic fields. We may thus be surrounded by highly complex, ultra-weak currents and fields, the existence of which no one has ever suspected until now, at least not ones involving microbes and dust. What is more, we cannot rule out the possibility that the toxic characters of some microbes will be cancelled out or enhanced by charge. We don't know which. And if there are electric currents and magnetic fields surrounding us within our charged microbial clouds, these too can have beneficial or harmful effects on us. I am inclined to suspect, however, that the average effects must be helpful, because otherwise how would we have survived throughout the ages? The electric currents and magnetic fields that would thus occur within our microbial clouds would be what is known as ultra-weak. This means they would be extremely hard to detect. Ultra-weak sounds as if such currents and fields would be of negligible effect. However, there is a massive amount of scientific evidence concerning the crucial importance of ultra-weak fields and currents in relation to the human body. Much of the work done in that field is furiously opposed by various corporate interests, especially those of the big power companies, because the studies largely are related to what is known as electropollution, a subject which big money wants to hush up because it threatens their financial interests. It is not only that living beneath power lines is dangerous, which is something everyone can readily understand, but also the intense radiation produced by 5G poses great risks to people. However, that is not for discussion at the moment. I mention it here only to point out how overwhelming the evidence is that the human body is ultra-sensitive to the ultra-weak, especially to what we will describe later as biophotons, and indeed to any and all forms of electromagnetism. We must not forget that the body itself is electromagnetic. The relevance of electricity and magnetism to the human body was revealed very dramatically in 1963, when Gerhard M. Ball, that's B-A-U-L-E, and Richard McPhee made the first scientific detection of a naturally occurring biomagnetic field in the human body, and they proved the existence of a magnetic field associated with the action of the human heart. The electrical and magnetic aspects of the human heart are now universally accepted, but it was very painful and difficult for scientific and medical experts to accept this discovery at the time, because it went against the body as a machine theory, by which everything was supposed to be chemical and mechanical. Modern machines use electricity, but the body as a machine theory did not allow for that, and was essentially based on models of clocks and 19th century factory machines. Pre-existing fixations, theories rigidly adhered to, ossified notions, and fixed opinions are the great enemies of progress in science. But scientists are human beings, with all the limitations that that implies. Over the decade that followed Ball and McPhee's findings, further understanding was gained, and in 1970, David B. Gaselowitz published a preliminary paper, and then in 1973 wrote a very lengthy technical account of the subject of the magnetic heart and biomagnetism, in which he said, quote, "The past decade has seen a dramatic improvement in the ability to measure biomagnetic fields. They are extremely small, about 1 million times weaker than the Earth's magnetic field in the case of fields of cardiac origin, and even smaller in the case of fields originating in the brain. Hence, the detection of these fields has been a major experimental challenge. Nevertheless, it has been possible to develop instrumentation so that such fields can now be measured almost routinely. These biomagnetic fields are crucial to our bioplasma bodies, as they continuously interact with our physical bodies through the actions of electricity and magnetism. We will return to the revolutionary idea of bioplasma bodies in the chapters that follow." Electromagnetic clouds around us. After I had written the above, Marco Bischoff, an eminent Swiss writer working in Germany on the frontiers of science, sent me copies of all the articles he had by Freeman W. Cope concerning the existence of superconductivity, which, as we have seen, occurs when electricity flows without any resistance, within organisms, including our own bodies. It was originally thought that superconductivity could only happen at a temperature not far above absolute zero. Then it was discovered to be possible at higher and higher temperatures, and then it became common to suggest that it could happen at room temperature. I had come across Cope's early articles in the mid-1970s and wanted to write about them at that time, but my literary agent and all potential publishers were scornful, insisting it was nonsense and that no one would be interested. Even to publish an article about it in a newspaper, and I was doing plenty of science stories for the media in the late 1970s, was impossible. There was a complete wall of steel erected in people's minds against this subject. I will be returning to this later. I only mention it now in order to explain that I asked my friend Marco if he had any articles by Cope, the best-known researcher into the subject, which I did not already have. He sent me some, and along with those he sent five more by Cope on an astounding branch of study of which I had no previous knowledge. Furthermore, they came to my attention shortly after I had finished writing about electrified dust and microbes forming a cloud around the human body. Talk about perfect timing. It is those articles by Cope which I will discuss now. Freeman Widener Cope was unquestionably one of the great pioneers of biochemical research. In 1982, he died rather young, aged only 51 or 52, so that his work was tragically cut short. As far as I can determine, he spent his entire professional career working for the U.S. Office of Naval Research, which, as we have seen, does all the secret work, quote, for the Navy, unquote, really shared with the entire American security establishment, and is scientifically by far the most important of the four main American defense security agencies. Cope was head of the biochemistry laboratory of the Naval Air Development Center in Johnsville, near Warminster, Pennsylvania. All of Cope's work was funded by designated grants from the Office of Naval Research, officially acknowledged at the end of each of his articles. Prior to his work on superconductivity, Cope had been engaged in wholly different routine work in the biochemistry division of the Aerospace Medical Research Department of the Bureau of Medicine and Surgery of the U.S. Naval Air Development Center of the U.S. Department of the Navy. He wrote a number of reports, and his report number 5, dated the 2nd of July 1970, was declassified at some time subsequent to 1979 so that we can see what he was doing. The title of the report was Activation Energies of Acceleration and Hypoxia Stress. Hypoxia is a deficiency of oxygen. He was studying the stresses imposed on pilots by rapid acceleration and oxygen deficiency. He concludes that moderate brain damage may result and points out that tolerance to acceleration stress is not limited simply by the ability of the nervous tissue to endure hypoxia, but must be dependent upon additional mechanisms. This shows that he was doing highly important normal work concerning the health of naval pilots. But then everything changed. Cope was taken away from his normal research, and instead he remained until his death the Naval Agency's special researcher into everything weird. The Office of Naval Research does not exist simply to figure out how to stop ships from sinking and facilitate communications between submarines. It has a huge remit, which covers almost any scientific subject you can imagine, many of those subjects being very far out indeed, beyond the known fringes of science. The Naval Agency even joins with or competes with the Air Force Agency to research the atmosphere. They are, of course, unaccountable to Congress for their budget being secret. All their scientists work under the most stringent security rules, have to sign many secrecy agreements, and can only publish what the agency permits them to publish. And yet, out of this secretive milieu, not only did an amazing discovery come, but the people vetting publications actually permitted it to appear in print. I suspect they realized their mistake too late, because it was not necessarily obvious at the time how much they were letting slip and what the implications would be. I suspect they also must eventually have become nervous of Freeman Cope, who appears to have been an idealistic scientist, and the last thing a security agency wants is an idealist of any kind. It is not easy to summarize briefly what Freeman Cope was proposing in his 5 revolutionary articles, because they cover complex matters to do with theories of electricity and magnetism, quantum theory, and some unfamiliar concepts of physics not normally discussed. But before I get to that, I must analyze how embarrassing the revelations of Cope really are regarding the Naval Agency's files. This cannot have occurred to the censors at the time, for nothing explicit is said that could have breached Cope's secrecy agreements. It is only when all 5 articles have been read carefully, if one knows something of the background, that it becomes clear what was really going on and why Cope became involved in this research in the first place. For what had clearly happened was that the Naval Agency had asked Cope to examine the seized secret papers of Wilhelm Reich and give his opinion as to whether there was anything to Reich's weird ideas. In other words, he was tasked with an evaluation of one of the stranger collections of scientific files in the agency's possession. What seized files? Wilhelm Reich, 1897 to 1957, was an Austrian psychoanalyst and one of the most brilliant students and protégés of Sigmund Freud. In 1922, he became the director of Freud's outpatient clinic. He began to develop ideas that went beyond Freud's, to do with the energy released in human orgasms. He began to speak openly of sexual matters and to promote more open sexuality in society. This caused a great deal of alarm in Vienna. He was also passionately anti-fascist, and he fled Austria for America in 1939. He lived there for the rest of his life. But in America, Reich caused even more alarm, because he was speaking openly of orgasms. And as everyone knows, Americans in the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s didn't have any. Reich's main interest in them was their release of a special kind of energy. He called this orgone energy, O-R-G-O-N E, and he regarded its release in orgasms as being only one of its many manifestations. It was, in his opinion, a genuine universal life energy. Reich carried out many elaborate researches, attempting to find out what this strange, undefined energy really was. He came to believe that most of it appeared to come streaming in from the sun, so he viewed it as part of what came to be known as the solar wind. But he believed it was not light, or electrons, or protons, or ions. It was something else. He did not know what. Reich's theory of orgone energy was that it was the essential life energy of all living beings, and that the sexual orgasm was a specific form of a general biological phenomenon occurring in all creatures in different forms and for varying purposes, but found in specialized form in humans sexually, to do with, quote, an involuntary contraction and expansion of the total plasma system, unquote, resulting in an energy discharge in which a bit of the orgone energy was released. He believed that orgone energy would occur in the form of tiny particles, which he called bions. Reich had concluded, quote, that every living organism is a membranous structure that contains an amount of orgone in its body fluids. It is an orgonautic system. Thus, the term orgone comes from organism and orgasm, and means an energy found within all organisms and basic to the orgasm reflex. Because he was a protege of Sigmund Freud, Reich emphasized the sexual part of this theory, causing a certain amount of hysteria amongst many people who did not like open discussion of sex at all. Reich had published his book, Die Funktion des Orgasmus, The Function of the Orgasm, in Vienna as early as 1927, carrying forward Freud's theories of the sexual energy called libido. Reich was not a physicist, and parts of his research were rather amateurish. Despite this, he made some significant and important discoveries. He also designed what he called orgone accumulators to capture and store the orgone energy. At the time, there was no explanation for how they worked, and most people naturally assumed they were a fantasy and that Reich must be a madman or a charlatan or both. But there were some people who knew that Reich had stumbled onto something. It is necessary to give some of the political background to this, as one of the side effects of what happened was to suppress for many decades any public discussions of plasma, especially of cosmic plasma, and any plasma or electronic functionalities within living systems. In Chapter 14, we will see related actions by the same people to suppress the work of the Nobel laureate Albert St. George, who, like Reich, had sought refuge in America. All these actions were part of the same systematic pattern of persecution intended to prevent public awareness of certain sensitive issues that many immigrant scientists imported into America after the Second World War for defense and security work. It was in 1947, the year of the formation of the CIA, that a campaign to attack and discredit Reich commenced. That was at the same time that Nazi scientists were being brought to America at the instigation of Alan Dulles, who in the 1930s had been employed by the Gestapo's front organization in America, the American subsidiary of IG Farben, which the Germans pronounce IG Farben, famous as the manufacturer of the poison gas that killed the Jews in the death camps. He had also refused to act to save the lives of Jews being killed by the Nazis, of which he was informed at least as early as 1942. In 1944, Dulles simulated horror at pretending to hear about the Holocaust for the first time, whereas he had known all about it for at least 2 years, and had not only refused to do anything to stop it, but prevented others from acting. The shocking details of Dulles's lies and duplicity in relation to this issue of the genocide of the Jews are documented by David Talbot of the New York Times In his book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government, published in 2015. So eager was Dulles to reach an accommodation with the Nazis before the Second World War ended that he initiated his own secret peace plan entitled Operation Sunrise. Falsely claiming that he was a personal representative and close friend of President Roosevelt. In pursuit of his plan, he secretly negotiated a peace deal, entirely without authority, with SS General Karl Wolff, who had previously been Himmler's chief of staff. Himmler was so fond of Wolff that he called him Wolfie. Now, this is a bit strange, because Hitler's secret code name was Dr. Wolff, and he frequently referred to himself in the third person as Wolff. So, there's something going on here. Wolfie was also popular with Hitler and was the principal liaison between Hitler and Himmler, and was always welcome at Hitler's dinner parties. The Nazi high command used to cite Wolfie as the ideal Aryan. As an old man, Wolfie recalled, "Hitler wanted to have me nearby because he knew that he could rely on me completely. He had known me for a long time and rather well." Despite being directly ordered by President Roosevelt not to negotiate with Wolfie, Dulles continued his own private American foreign policy by plotting a deal with Wolfie. Wolfie was in fact negotiating a potential deal on behalf of his boss Himmler. The plan of Dulles failed, but then, as they were such chums, Dulles went on to save Wolfie's life. The sleazy details of this treasonous tale have been discovered by Talbot and are given in his book. Dulles was a close friend of Hitler's banker, Hjalmar Schacht, president of the Reichsbank, who had created a thriving economy in Germany, which enabled Hitler to go to war. Dulles was also a close friend of the American traitor Tom McKittrick, a former New York banker, who in his role as head of the Bank of International Settlements, BIS, at Basel in Switzerland, which is very near to Bern, where Dulles was based after November 1942, treasonously laundered stolen gold for the Nazis and obtained foreign currencies for them to enable them to buy essential war materials, such as the tungsten from Portugal and the oil from the Plesetsk oil fields of Romania. McKittrick even went so far as to receive many tons of gold from the Nazis that he knew to have come from the teeth of Jews murdered in the death camps. Later, Dulles was to defy direct orders from President Truman about bringing SS men to America, in defiance of American law. One can probably attribute to Dulles the origin of the CIA's traditional arrogance, its certainty that it knows best, and its contempt for mere presidents. In other words, we may probably regard Alan Dulles as the founder of what has come to be called by the name of the secret state. Certainly the partiality of Dulles for the Nazis is well established, and authoritarianism seems to have been institutionalized within the CIA, an organization in which love for democracy seems to be in short supply. As Talbot says of Dulles, viewed from the perspective of 1942, he was running his own foreign policy, and from the perspective of today, dead for nearly half a century, Dulles's shadow still darkens the land. After the war, Project Paperclip and other similar projects with different names got properly organized, and the American security establishment was being powerfully manipulated by the imported Germans, some of whom went straight into important positions. Many of them went to work for the U.S. Army, Navy, and Air Force security agencies. The Air Force was formed for the first time in 1947, having previously been a branch of the Army. It was easy to attack Wilhelm Reich, who was a highly eccentric loner. Reich was arrested, his orgone accumulators were hacked to pieces with axes by FBI men in front of his eyes, their remains burned, and there were 2 book burnings of many tons of his published works. This was ironical, because Reich's books had been publicly burned on the orders of Himmler's SS in Austria years before. And now here were the American imported SS men doing it to him again with the aid of their FBI colleagues. Yes, this really happened in the United States, the land of the free and the home of the brave. The SS men also violently hated Wilhelm Reich for his anti-Nazi 1933 publication, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, in which Reich was merciless in attacking Hitler and the Nazis. And he hits home with pungent personal observations about Hitler, such as this one, quote, "He assures us that only once in his life did he cry, when his mother died," unquote. Such critical observations about the Führer would have enraged the Nazis, for Hitler was meant to be the ultimate Superman, capable of feeling and sharing all the emotions of his people, the Volk. To make things worse for himself, in 1946, Reich's Orgone Institute Press published an English translation of that provocative book, which until then had been available only in German, though most copies had been destroyed by Himmler. It was effectively a public slap in the face to Alan Dulles and his friends, and to their entire policy of bringing large numbers of SS officers to America and putting them into positions of power and influence at the heart of the American security establishment. In fact, in June of 1946, Dulles went further and helped to arrange for the Eastern Europe and Russia wing of the Nazi security apparatus to be transferred lock, stock, and barrel under its leader, Lieutenant General Reinhard Gehlen, 1902-1979, into a spy organization called the Gehlen Org, funded by the United States and ostensibly under American control, which was absorbed into the CIA following the CIA's formation in 1947. With all this going on, Wilhelm Reich was considered a very dangerous enemy, lest the American public come to know that the Nazis now secretly composed the entire Eastern wing of America's Foreign Spy Service, not to mention all those many Nazis who were being brought to America to work on American soil in the most secret projects, such as mind control, and of course, in the development of rockets and missiles, as most people know. But burning Reich's books was not all. Reich was committed to prison and mysteriously died there not long before he was due to apply for parole and be released. There are suspicions that he was murdered to shut him up. But the most important thing of all which happened was that his most important secret research papers were seized by the FBI and, quote, disappeared, unquote. And that brings us back to Freeman Cope's 5 articles. After studying the articles carefully, reading between the lines of what Cope says, and knowing something of how the weird scientific branches of the security agencies operate, it became obvious to me, and it must have been obvious at the time to others, that the FBI had given all of Reich's seized papers to the Office of Naval Research in the 1950s for evaluation and safekeeping. And that is what brought Freeman Cope to his own discoveries, partly based, as he freely admits, upon Reich's researches. After all, how else would he have known so much about the scientific aspects of Reich's researches, not all of which had ever been made public by Reich? The Naval Agency must have selected Cope, who worked for them, to do some work on Reich's papers because he himself had recently discovered strange forms of energy within the body by suggesting that superconductivity took place along the double helix of the DNA molecule and used organic Josephson junctions, named after their discoverer Brian Josephson, who received the Nobel Prize for Physics for their discovery. These junctions use the weird quantum tunneling effect mentioned earlier in order to control and modify the flow of currents, sometimes in surprising ways. We will return to this subject to discuss them in Chapter 14. Cope's superiors must have thought him well equipped for having another look at Reich's strange files and papers. I might add that all my attempts to contact former colleagues of Cope to learn more about him have met with total silence, which tells me that these colleagues are bound by secrecy agreements and are terrified to say anything at all. That is the background. Now for the discoveries. Cope came to the conclusion that each of us is surrounded by yet another invisible cloud. He describes it as, quote, a gas of electromagnetic dipoles, unquote. A dipole is so called because it has two electromagnetic poles, a north pole and a south pole. A dipole may be a molecule or some other object that has both poles. He believes this cloud can be detected on rare occasions by sensitive persons who tend to call it an aura. Cope stresses that he wished to investigate this by sweeping away mystical theories and tackling the matter purely scientifically. Cope had no knowledge of the microbial clouds, which I have described, and which would not be discovered until 34 years after his death. Nor was he knowledgeable about microscopic dust, whether charged or uncharged, and nor was he apparently knowledgeable about plasma either, except in the sense that he may have known about Reich's researches into something that seemed a lot like plasma. That means, of course, that he was also not familiar with the prevalence of dust in plasma and all the phenomena associated with that. What he discovered was therefore something entirely extra, though the two phenomena may well be intimately related. He says, quote, it is proposed that in the universe around us exist a large number of particles, each of which is both an electric and a magnetic dipole, unquote. Apart from Wilhelm Reich's unexplained findings, Cope's initial stimulus appears to have come from the work over several decades by Alexander Rothen of the Rockefeller University. Rothen had also been researching a strange phenomenon since 1942. He had been working with proteins, and he had discovered that molecules could in certain circumstances interact with molecules on the other side of a layer of fat, which should have been completely impenetrable to them. Proteins tend to be spherical, and he started spreading them on the surface of water and discovered that they more or less collapsed and went flat. Normally, by being flattened, they could not have been expected to be capable of interacting with antibodies from the bloodstream. He laid a layer of beef fat, stearite, across them and proved that it was impermeable to any kind of direct diffusion of molecules across it. But he then noticed that the flattened proteins were interacting with antibodies laid on top of the fat anyway, with which they could have no conceivable form of direct contact. It must be stressed that according to conventional thinking, any form of interaction between these molecules other than direct contact was deemed to be impossible. This was when Rothen discovered mysterious action at a distance, previously only observed in the realm of quantum mechanics, operating inside organisms in the everyday realm and having a material effect. Otherwise known as quantum entanglement, this action at a distance, which Einstein famously called spooky, is the puzzling way that pairs of particles can seem to interact even if they are separated in space, indeed, even if they are light years apart. As a result of this astonishing finding, Rothen began an immensely long series of careful experiments, and he was still working to try to solve this mystery in the 1970s. Cope not only drew upon articles published by Rothen between 1971 and 1976, he was also in touch directly with Rothen and received a copy from him of an article that had not yet been published, entitled Influence of Metallic Shields on Presumably Cosmic Radiation. Rothen had discovered that there was something else peculiar going on, and it concerned insufficiently understood electric and magnetic phenomena, and some strange form of cosmic radiation, which was also capable of having material effects over large distances. One needs to recall that Wilhelm Reich had also been concerned with some strange form of cosmic radiation. Cope wondered whether what Reich had looked at and what Rothen was looking at might be the same thing. In going back through even older studies, Cope became intrigued by the meticulously documented and lengthy experiments carried out in the mid-19th century by Baron Karl von Reichenbach, whose extremely large book, Researches on Magnetism, Electricity, Heat, Light, had been translated into English and published as long ago as 1850. Reichenbach's work was at one time fairly well known, but it had been regarded as antique and of little relevance for nearly a century when Cope rediscovered it. He believed it contained much valuable information. Reichenbach reported that many individuals whom he tested insisted that they could see faint auras around the poles of magnets, as well as around people's heads. But Reichenbach was led to formulate a concept of what he called odic force, O-D-I-C, odic force, to refer to some unknown energy that was involved. Reichenbach's odic force seemed to Cope to be similar to Reich's orgone energy. Reichenbach did not, however, discuss the forbidden subject of sex, as sex did not yet exist in 1850, it seems. Another strange cosmic force of vital magnetism was proposed in 1871 by the supernatural novelist Edward Bulwer Lytton in his novel The Coming Race, though Cope does not mention this. Bulwer Lytton appears to have taken his idea of vril, V-R-I-L, from Reichenbach's odic force. Strangely enough, some of the occult Nazis seriously believed in the actual existence of vril, despite its having appeared in an admitted work of fiction. They apparently believed that Bulwer Lytton knew of its true existence and revealed it in intentionally disguised form by proposing it within the context of a novel. And this vril became very seriously considered by the Nazis as really existing. Cope also discovered that Rothen was moving on from his discovery of weird quantum effects in proteins to building electronic devices that would duplicate them. He comments on Rothen's experiments and the type of particles forming the body clouds suggested by his findings. Quote, Rothen's magnetic electrode experiments seem to require that it, the type of particle suggested by Rothen, be a magnetic particle, which suggests the possibility that it is a magnetic monopole. That's a particle having a single pole, not two, as with dipoles. However, magnetic monopoles have never, with one controversial exception, been observed experimentally despite careful searches. Unquote. Discouraged at the unlikelihood of single-poled magnetic monopoles really existing, Cope fell back on the dipoles that I mentioned a moment ago. Any magnetic object will normally have a north and a south pole, which is to say, di, or two poles, and suggested them instead. Well, since Cope's day, magnetic monopoles have come back, and as we are about to see, they are fantastically important and wide-ranging in their implications, and so worth taking the time to understand. The famous Nobel Prize-winning physicist Paul Dirac had predicted the existence of magnetic monopoles in 1931 and published the quantum physics equations that showed it. His arguments are very convincing. In his 1931 paper, Dirac says, "The object of this paper is to show that quantum mechanics does not really preclude the existence of isolated magnetic poles. On the contrary, the present formalism of quantum mechanics, when developed naturally, without the imposition of arbitrary restrictions, leads inevitably to wave equations whose only physical interpretation is the motion of an electron in the field of a single magnetic pole, unquote. In 1948, he published an expanded version of this theory, which has been largely ignored, though it has the potential to revolutionize much of contemporary physics. In his 1948 paper, Dirac more emphatically than ever suggested that magnetic monopoles must exist. In the various discussions of magnetic monopoles that I have encountered, Dirac's paper of 1931 tends to be cited, but I do not recall anyone citing his follow-up paper of 1948, which expands the theory considerably. In the 1948 paper, of which I have an original copy, Dirac says, quote, "In 1931, I gave a primitive theory which described the action of a pole in the field of a charged particle whose motion is given, or the motion of a charged particle in the field of a pole whose motion is given." The present paper sets up a general theory of charged particles and poles in interaction through the medium of the electromagnetic field. The idea which makes this generalization possible consists in supposing each pole to be at the end of an unobservable string, which is the line along which the electromagnetic potentials are singular, and introducing dynamic coordinates and momenta to describe the motion of the strings. The whole theory then comes out by the application of standard methods. The theory developed in the present paper is essentially symmetrical between electric charges and magnetic poles, unquote. This brilliant paper by Dirac seems largely to have escaped notice by his fellow physicists. Dirac's idea of a string is also very suggestive. My own instinct is not to think of the string as being straight, but on the contrary, that it must exist either in helical form or in toroidal form. That is, existing on one or other of the two circularities of a toroidal surface, unless linking the two. In fact, to say that a particle is a string is effectively to say that it is a filament. And filaments like to spiral helically, and because they also like to spiral as double helixes, this might apply to those paired electrons known as Cooper pairs, which are discussed later. These matters require deeper consideration than an aside, however. On the 30th of January 2014, Des McMorrow and Steve Bramwell of the London Centre for Nanotechnology announced their proof of the existence of these monopoles. On the 4th of September 2015, scientists of the Universitat Autonoma de Barcelona in Spain announced that they had actually produced magnetic monopoles. Then, Georges Lauchac, president of the Fondation Louis Debré in Paris, and the German physicist Harald Stumpf, a former student of Werner Heisenberg, published a remarkable book in 2015 that revives magnetic monopoles and contains a veritable tsunami of horribly complex mathematics, a whole book full of it, in fact, to back it up. Indeed, I proofread Georges Lauchac's contribution for him to improve the English. As English is only his third language, his first being Russian and his second being French. Steve Bramwell has stated, quote, "We have observed monopole currents analogous to electricity." He also agrees that it should eventually be possible to harness monopole currents for technology, though that is a long way off. The evidence for the existence of magnetic monopoles keeps piling up, and many physicists are now talking increasingly about magnetic monopole plasmas. This is very important for us, because it means that there may be portions of the Kordalevsky clouds that are plasmas which are not made of charged particles, but instead of magnetic monopoles. In July of 2019, a paper appeared in Nature reporting experiments that appear to have confirmed the existence of magnetic monopole plasmas. It referred to numerous other investigators, papers, findings, and theories about this subject. This paper reported the results of investigations with a superconducting device known as a SQUID, to investigate whether the noise that magnetic monopoles would make, according to theory, really exists. They found it and said, quote, "Intriguingly, magnetic monopole flux noise amplified by squid is audible to humans," unquote. They say of their findings that they are consistent with other studies that imply that dysprosium dioxide, titanium dioxide, and I should say that dysprosium is never found in nature, but produced in the lab where it's known for its high magnetic strength, and HO2Ti2O7, that is, HO2 is hydrogen superoxide, O7 is an anion of oxygen, and in combination means heptoxide, contain a plasma of emergent magnetic monopoles. And they cite 9 references to other papers from Nature, the Physical Review, and so on. A 2016 paper they cite discussed both positive and negative magnetic monopoles, which would be the magnetic equivalents of electrons and protons. In other words, there may be a whole other science of plasma taking shape, which verifies the 1979 predictions of Freeman Cope, though he is forgotten. Let us pause briefly to consider why this is so significant. Scientists expect their theories to be symmetrical, and for the most part, symmetries are a good sign that your theory may be on the right lines. The established theory of electromagnetism, called the Maxwell-Heaviside equations, named after the two scientists who formulated them, has a symmetry when it comes to fields. There are both magnetic fields and electric fields. But there is no symmetry when it comes to currents. There are electric currents, but apparently no magnetic currents. In order to complete the symmetry, and for there to be magnetic currents, there would need to be magnetic particles, which, like electrons, the particles of electricity, have a charge operating in a single direction. But all magnetized particles known about operate in equal and opposite directions, which is to say they have two poles, one negative and one positive. Therefore, in standard physics, there is no such thing as a magnetic monopole. The quest to discover them has been called the Holy Grail of physics, because not only would this give symmetry to the theory of electromagnetism, which with gravity is the most important formative factor in the universe, it would open up a vast new dimension of theoretical physics when it comes to exploring the fields that give our universe the form it has. As for the practical implications and how to harness the power of magnetic monopoles, well, that was what Cope was interested in discovering in his top secret work. In what I will now quote from Cope, he uses the polite phrase, "our unknown something," to refer to the strange phenomenon, and he has coined a wonderful phrase, "magnet auras," to describe the clouds around magnets which are visible to some people. Cope says, quote, "The observation that our unknown something seems to collect near surfaces of magnets, magnet auras, suggests that we may indeed have magnetic dipoles." He means magnetic dipole particles, but we can now add also magnetic monopoles, which are pulled into regions of high magnetic field gradient, that is, regions near magnet surfaces, unquote. In other words, since it is known that Cope's unknown something accumulates near magnet surfaces, he reasons that the unknown something must be composed of magnetic particles. He assumes that they would have two poles, north and south. But since his death, magnetic monopoles having been confirmed, we may add that they might just as well have only one pole, and hence be monopoles, as he had initially hoped. He continues, expanding his comments from magnetic particles to electric ones. Quote, "Our unknown something seems also to collect near the surface of the human body, human auras. No magnetic field gradients exist there." A gradient, by the way, refers to a flow of energy, whether magnetic or electrical. However, if our magnetic dipole is also an electric dipole, it would collect also at regions of high electric gradients. The human body forms an electric discontinuity with the electric field around the Earth, thus causing large electric gradients near the body's surface. Therefore, electric dipoles should collect there. In other words, since human bodies have electric fields around them, forming bubbles within the normal electric field on the Earth's surface, COPE's particles would collect there. COPE goes on to explain how these new insights mean that Wilhelm Reich's supposedly crazy orgone accumulators might really have worked. After explaining how a sandwich of dissimilar materials arranged in a certain way, perhaps not unlike the layers in Rothen's original experiments, might be able to trap such particles, he makes this explicit statement, quote, "Because of this effect, a box made of two layers of dissimilar materials might accumulate and concentrate electromagnetic dipoles from a surrounding gas of electromagnetic dipoles analogous to the experimental observations of Reich," unquote. So the Navy's attempt to see if he could make sense of Reich's findings is getting somewhere. He adds, quote, "Reich seemed to observe accumulation of some sort of solar radiation with physiological activity within bilayer boxes, sheet iron covered by cellulose. We may expect bilayer structures to act as diodes or rectifiers. Both of those are devices that conduct a current in one direction. For electromagnetic dipoles, a box constructed from such bilayer sheets might therefore operate as an electromagnetic dipole accumulator, which would explain some of the phenomena observed by Reich." This is an astonishing revelation. Reich was sent to prison for making orgone accumulator boxes of exactly this kind, which he insisted were trapping some unknown solar energy that he named orgone. Here we have COPE 23 years after Reich's death, and obviously entrusted by the American security establishment with evaluating Reich's research papers, concluding that Reich's orgone accumulators probably worked after all, and paving the way for these to be understood in terms of magnetic monopoles that have since been shown to exist. COPE is talking about reconstructing the very same boxes that were chopped to pieces with axes in front of Reich's eyes by FBI men outside his house, and their constituent parts thrown onto a fire with his books. It is beginning to look as if Wilhelm Reich may have been a 20th century Giordano Bruno. What kind of mad frenzy possessed the FBI men to behave like this? As I've already mentioned, Reich's books had previously been burned by Himmler's SS, and then they were burned again by fanatical opponents of his scientific findings within the American government. At this point in his account, COPE begins to refer to the work of another brilliant scientist who seriously challenged orthodoxy, Herbert Charles Corbin, that's Corben. In his day job, Corbin was one of the world's leading experts on spinning particles, who wrote the definitive book on the subject for that time in 1968, which is so heavily mathematical that you need swamp boots to wade through it. But when left free for his thoughts to roam, Corbin was an astonishingly bold thinker, as we see in a rather visionary article that was published in 1978, from which COPE draws. COPE and Corbin were also in personal touch and exchanged information privately, as COPE makes clear. Anyone who thinks that monopoles and orgone energies are way-out phenomena will perhaps be surprised to hear that the subject of tachyons is even more so. That's T-A-C-H-Y-O-N-S, tachyons. And Corbin seriously investigated tachyons, along with a small number of like-minded scientists. What are tachyons? They are particles that travel faster than the speed of light, and they are predicted by relativity theory. What? You may exclaim. But surely it is relativity theory that says that nothing can go faster than the speed of light. Well, not really. But if we get into the speed of light, then this book will become twice as long, and we cannot allow that to happen. A tachyon, like the magnetic monopole, is a particle that exists in theory, but is in practice a very rare bird, which most scientists would probably say does not exist in the real world. Before we get too skeptical, we should remember the way physics evolves. It often happens, and happened in the case of the Higgs boson, for example, that a particle is shown to exist in theory many years before it is actually verified by experiment. So I will have to ask you to swallow hard and try to take my word for it that tachyons may turn out, as magnetic monopoles have now done, to exist after all, despite a chorus of doubters shouting, "Crazy!" The moral to this story is, when someone shouts crazy at you, put your fingers in your ears and carry on. Drawing upon discussions with Corbin, Cope was able to expand his theory of clouds of dipoles surrounding the human body and suggest that clouds of electromagnetic monopoles might actually be tachyons. This would mean that even the laziest person on Earth, the teenager who sleeps all day, for instance, may at all times be surrounded by a cloud of particles going faster than the speed of light. So when an exasperated mother shouts at her teenage son, "Get out of bed, it's the middle of the afternoon," he might justifiably call back to her, "I'm completely exhausted because my body cloud has been going faster than light all night long." Without going into all the technical details, fascinating as they are, I shall give some of the conclusions that Cope comes to on the basis of all of this. He and Corbin worked out together that diffraction patterns, which are interference patterns of waves that can tell you the frequencies of the waves, of tachyons, could create certain resonance interactions or standing wave patterns of interactions between the tachyons and crystals. Remember what I said earlier about solitons and standing waves? To explain resonance interactions, which can create standing waves, would require too lengthy an account. But when wishing to understand resonance, think of music and harmonious chords as opposed to those that are not. The most harmonious chords are called fifths by musicians and are examples of harmonious resonance. Cope is saying here that if tachyons do exist, their rhythmic interactions would naturally make them resonate with crystalline structures in intimate and interesting ways. This is a wonderful vision and a joy to conceptualize. Critics may say it is highly speculative, but Cope found a way to describe the relationship between crystals and mysterious energies in scientific terms. He found a scientific language for it. Cope goes further. He comes up with mechanisms in the form of superconductive regions to explain how these particles might be trapped within the body. Again, to remind you, superconductivity is when electricity travels without resistance. He also suggests that on the planetary scale, these phenomena could create a standing energy grid, a vast grid system of resonant standing waves of Earth energy, in quotes. Of course, the New Agers have been saying this for decades. He adds, as a footnote, that this could explain dowsing, if we all have these particles inside us, rendering some people hypersensitive to invisible energy fields. In relation to dowsing, returning to the subject of magnetic monopoles, Cope says, quote, "My hypothesis is that the long-sought magnetic monopoles are all around us and are in the form of delocalized tachyon, faster-than-light particles, clouds, which form periodic wave functions detectable by sensitive quantum mechanical processes in man. The general pattern of reported experimental observations seems to suggest that delocalized clouds, wave functions, of tachyon magnetoelectric monopole polymers," he means substances made up of large molecules, "surround all solid and liquid objects, and that these are detectable by sensitive persons trained in dowsing techniques. The detection is presumably by quantum mechanical interactions with living cells. Dirac monopoles exist as large, delocalized, polymeric clouds or wave functions with spatial periodicities." I realize that this is very technical language and probably confusing. What he is saying is that there are these clouds surrounding each and every one of us, and indeed not just us, but all liquid and solid objects. Thus, we are all surrounded not only by charged dust and microbes, but by even smaller electromagnetic particles, which are whizzing round us constantly faster than the speed of light and causing effects that we have not yet even begun to explore or explain. And in this connection, I should add that bees and flowers also have an electromagnetic dimension. For scientists at the University of Bristol have proved that bees, when flying around, are positively charged, and sense the flowers that are negatively charged, using specially sensitive small hairs on their faces. The pollen that they gather also becomes charged, and then the charged dust is scattered in the air by the bees rustling around inside the flowers. We may thus look upon bees and flowers as engaged in a continuous orgy of charged intercourse with one another, generating and displaying their auras and creating plenty of charged dust in miniature clouds as they do so. It really is true to say, we live in an electromagnetic world and are only beginning to understand how it works. All of us are electric people, full of multiple currents of both negative charge called electricity and positive charge called protosity. Since charged currents always generate magnetic fields, we are also all full of multiple magnetic fields. When we say that people sometimes have magnetic personalities, we may be closer to the truth than we thought.